Here we got for Doc Charles, and I'll try to be quiet here as I help.
That's all right.
Yay!
She's cheering the quiet. Okay, so forgive me. My day this morning started in Austin, Texas, where I was at the South by Southwest conference, which is basically a party traveling as a conference, and with lots of music and lots of drinking and staying out late, which I mostly resisted, but I still only got about 2 hours of sleep last night because I got on a plane at 3 a.m. I got up to get on a plane at 3 a.m. So, and then I ended up sitting next to people I knew on the plane, so I didn't sleep either. So it was all good stuff. And the second was like, well, you have to come and talk to somebody at O'Reilly. So I got here. I didn't even know O'Reilly had an office here, and that it's like, it's near Fresh Pond. It's like really near my house in Arlington. So that soaked up more time. And I anyway. So I'm a little bit. If I fall asleep on my feet here, you'll know why it is. So I've been writing one way or another for Linux Journal since 1996, and my title there is senior editor, which basically means I'm the oldest editor on staff, and it is not by any technical qualifications. I'm the least technical editor at Linux Journal, and I'm sure I'm less technical than everybody else in this room. The only code I know is Morse, and that tells you a little bit about how old I am, as a matter of fact. So I was a not very good, but a very committed ham radio operator till my parents sent me off to, I was a lousy student, so they sent me off to this Lutheran academic correctional institution for high school, and I had to leave all my gear behind. But my hacking, what's that?
Still active?
Not really, no. I'd love to be, you know, but I just have so much stuff going on. I still have some of the gear. I think I've lost the transmitter. It was a Johnson Viking 1, and I still have. If anybody wants it, I can ship it from North Carolina. A Hammerland HQ129X receiver, 1940s vintage.
Holy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fun thing. Yeah. I soldered a lot of things, and I stabbed a lot of things with screwdrivers when I was young. But I didn't hack any code. But Linux Journal curiously started as a free software magazine. It was going to be called the Free Software Journal, and as so often happens, there was a falling out between Richard and somebody, and in this case it was Phil Hughes, who started Linux Journal. And I don't know so much a falling out with Richard, but basically Phil fell in love with Linux. He just, you know, he was all about free software, and I was kind of on the list. We were friends, and I just sort of helped him out. And then one day he said to the list that, you know, he was organizing to start the magazine, he said, hey, you know, I just ran across this kid that's doing this stuff. And then that was like in 93. So Linux had already been at it for a couple years. But Linux Journal came out in 1994. So I have a tab on that here. But this is the table of contents from 1994. And page down there. Yeah, so note this here. So the interview with Linus, the author of Linux by Robert Young. That's Bob Young, who was our first editor in chief, and went and he didn't get along with Phil, so he went off and he started Red Hat. So and now he's a multi-zillionaire. And I'm pretty sure the Debian distribution was actually by Ian Murdoch and not John A. Murdoch, or maybe Ian's real name is John A. I don't know, but we were very much a Debian house for, I think we probably still are to the degree that we have a house. We were in Seattle in those days. I was the first editor hired full time that did not come to Seattle, and then that sort of broke things up. And after that, there were no two people in the same area code after 2 or 3 years, became a completely virtual publication. And Linux Journal, does anybody here read Linux Journal? I'm just curious. Wow, all of you, jeez, whoa, bingo. That's awesome.
We even subscribe.
That's awesome. Well, that's awesome. Well, you know, you're keeping it alive because, I mean, the magazine business is horrible right now. And so we're all, you know, tightening our belts and everything else and trying to keep it going. It's not an easy thing to do. And the difficult thing, really, is that Linux won. You know, we're in GandhiCon 4 on Linux. So it's, you know, what was really radical in its day is now 2x4s. It's what we're all building with. So anyway, that's a bit about Linux history. What happened for me is that what Phil wanted me to cover and what I started covering from the beginning was really where Linux meets business. So I was kind of like the business editor of Linux Journal, and oh, he wanted me to cover like the big picture stuff, and that's what I've been doing. And in the course of that, starting in 96, actually it was 95, I think, when I first started writing some stuff for them, but covering the net and the growth of the web and the rest of it. And so in the course of doing that, I got, like a lot of people did, kind of cranky about what happened during the dot-com boom. And I was in Silicon Valley. I'm still basically a Silicon Valley guy. But I lived in Silicon Valley, in Palo Alto, and various places on the peninsula. And at that time, like by 1999, there was like $25 billion a year, which exceeded the gross domestic product of half the countries in the world, rolling in from VCs to dumb companies, mostly dumb ideas in Silicon Valley alone, all of which are predicated on the idea that we're going to create on the web something that we have off the web. We're going to make money by advertising, for example. We're actually going through another bubble now. I still think advertising is a bubble, even though Google's done very well with it. And in part of being annoyed about that, we being three other guys and myself that just talked on the phone a lot and emailed back and forth a lot about what we thought was not being well understood, especially by the VCs, about the internet, we decided that one day that we would just, why don't we just take the things we think are true and nail them up on the web like Martin Luther nailed up 95 theses. And since 95 theses worked for Martin Luther, we made 95 theses. And since a manifesto worked for Karl Marx, we created a manifesto, and we called it the Kluetrain Manifesto. And the Kluetrain Manifesto went up on the web in about this time in 1999. And how many people here are familiar with Kluetrain? You know, probably about half of you. So Kluetrain was a rant, and the term Kluetrain was based on an old Silicon Valley epitaph that said, the Kluetrain stopped there four times a day for 10 years and they never took delivery, right? So, and one of us said that to another one of us. We looked it up on what was then the Internet and saw the domain name was available, and I bought it for $75, and that was all the thought that went into the name for that thing. So, that was it. There was no marketing, nothing. And we were like, three of us were actually, I mean, I made more money as a marketing consultant still. That's how I, you know, when I walked the streets, that's what I did and with doing Linux Journal on the side. And, there was a line in the Kluetrain Manifesto, which I could possibly bring it up, but Chris Locke really, he's really the most out there of the four co-authors of Kluetrain, that galvanized us. And the line was this, it said, we are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers. We are human beings, and our reach exceeds your grasp. Deal with it. And that, just that steady bit, it sent it out as a little GIF, actually, a little dot GIF in an email as an attachment. And that kind of got our blood going. And that, it turned out, and we never even thought about this, but when we put up, because again, it was a rant, we just wrote stuff until we got to 95 theses, frankly, and then we just put this thing up, and we started it off with people of Earth, you know. It was kind of a goof. It was half serious, but it was also a goof, and it was a test. It was like, well, this is the stuff we think is true, and let's see if other people resonate with it. So we put the thing up, and I had not realized when we wrote that we were really writing in the first-person plural voice as customers, as the marketplace, not as marketers. And we were addressing companies. We were addressing, useit.com, Jacob Nielsen he was a major usability guru. But one day he told me, he said, what you guys did was you defected from marketing and you sided with markets against marketing. And that's really what resonated with people. So Kluetrain went up, and within a few days, the Wall Street Journal had it covered, and all of a sudden my emails went from like 25 to about 300 to 500 a day. And within a few weeks we had a book offer, and we took it, and we wrote the book that summer, and the book came out in January of 2000, and was Amazon's number one sales and marketing bestseller for the next 13 months. And it's still like in the top 10,000 or something on Amazon. We're coming out with a new version this summer. Not a new version, it's called Clue Train at 10. Which is just, it's the original book with just a few more chapters added by the four authors. But the reason I bring all that up is because something always bothered me, and that was that in that statement that Chris made, we are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers, and our reach exceeds your grasp, addressing that to sellers, essentially, and then deal with it, is that it's not really true. Our reach does not exceed sellers' grasp. One of the points we made in the Clue Train book was that industry won the Industrial Revolution. And ever since industry won the Industrial Revolution, sellers have been creating the terms by which buyers buy, for the most part. We live in an industrial society where the sellers make the rules. The bigger the seller, the bigger the rules. And if you want any evidence for that, just look at loyalty cards you got in your pockets, or all the identities that are given to you that you carry around in your wallets, all of them different, all of them from different organizations. All silos, all proprietary, all incompatible, right? So, and I realized that not too long after Clue Train came out, that all of the stuff that I saw Linux as helping cure in the computer industry was still wrong with business. In many ways, what I saw was wrong with computing was and I'm not alone, pretty much everybody in the free software and open source community saw this as well, that it came down to, in a way, what Walt Whitman said in Leaves of Grass. There was this little soliloquy he has in the middle of it, where he says, I could turn and live with the animals, they are so placid and self-contained, and not one of them worships one of their kind that lived long ago, and not one of them complains about his condition. He goes on, and then he says, not one of them is demented with the mania of owning things. And that was it, and I thought, well, that's really, there's nothing wrong with owning things, something wrong with having a mania about owning things. And there was a mania about owning things in the computer business and in the networking business. And the Linux cured it to a large degree in the computing area, and the internet cured it in the network area. But we don't have the cure in business. Business is still largely siloed with these large sellers. We have these silos in our lives. And it's interesting, if you talk to a large company, there's one I was talking to last summer, he was the head of government affairs for a big box store. And he was interested in VRM, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And he said, you know, we're really a good company, even though what we do is our business is we pave a farm and put a box in the middle of it and then attract people to it. But we do all these good things for our customers. We call them guests. And 80% of our customers are women, and 80% of our executives are women. And he goes on about it, and he says, we do everything we can to own the customer. And I said, what's another word for owning a human being?
Slavery.
Yeah, exactly. And he says, oh my God, why do we talk like that? And I said, because you're talking to yourselves. Right? And inside business, there's this insularity that that Alvin Toffler wrote about. How many of you are familiar with Alvin Toffler, the futurist who wrote Future Shock many years ago? But he wrote a book in 1979, came out in 1980, called The Third Wave. And in The Third Wave, he said that there was the agrarian age, and that was succeeded by the industrial age, and the industrial age would be succeeded by an information age. And the information age was then just beginning, it was at its dawn. But he said, in the information age, in the industrial age, rather, there was this problem that we had, where he called it an invisible wedge in our heads. The invisible wedge in our heads was one between production and consumption. When we go to work, we're producers. And what we do at work is we try to own the customer. And we treat customers like shit, basically. And then we go home, and now we're on the other side of our heads, where we're the consumer, and we're dealing with companies trying to own us and basically, for the most part, misunderstanding us. And he called us the invisible wedge in our heads, and we mentioned that in Clue Train as well. So just to go back in time a little bit, there was after I started writing for Linux Journal in the mid-90s, and And we had computers in our house, and my wife is not technical, but who became, you know, proficient enough at using a computer, and the web came along, and e-commerce began happening on the net with Amazon and with eBay and a bunch of other retailers. She said something to me that was one of the most profound questions I'd ever heard since the web came along, since e-commerce came along. She said, "Why can't I take my shopping cart from one site to another?" A naive question, right? But it was I thought it was a profound one, because that's a flaw. You know, you should be able to take the thing that you use to relate to multiple vendors and move it between one and another. And yet you couldn't. Amazon gave you their shopping cart that worked their way, and eBay gave you one that worked their way, and every other outfit gave you one that worked their way, just in the same way that today all of them give you loyalty cards that work their way and their way and their way. And that stuck in my mind. That stuck in my mind as something that needed to be hacked, something that needed to be done. When we move around the web, we're basically acquiring cookies from all these different sites, right? And that's how they know us. We don't have anything equivalent for how we know them. We don't have the tools for doing that yet. So what I wanted to do, what I realized after a while that I wanted to do, was deal with unfinished business that Clutrain left undone to some degree. And I'd write about it in Linux Journal, and I've got a pretty widely read blog that started about the same time as Clutrain came out. It was in 1999. In fact, if you look me up, even though we did Clutrain, and even though I've been writing for Linux Journal forever, I'm certainly better known for the blog than for anything else. And also it takes the least amount of time, which is an interesting case of leverage, and kind of a lesson there. In any case, So what happened was, starting in the 2000, 2002 or so, I began to think that the problem was one of identity, that we really don't control our identities very well. There's no simple protocol or anything else to help us govern our identities. Our identities are all given to us by somebody else. All the cards we carry in our wallets, there's one from the DMV, and there's one from the state, and there's one from the, you know, this library, and one from the university, and one from the other university, and you know, one from the Visa company, and I carry four different cards from United Airlines because I'm a frequent flyer for United Airlines, and there are four different siloed systems inside of United that don't really even communicate with each other very well. But in each case, I have a name that I was born with. I'm not even known by that name for the most part. My real name's David, but people call me Doc. Nobody names their kid Doc, but I just acquired that along the way. I don't have a doctorate, by the way. It's a fossil remnant of a radio identity I had at a little station at Duke University in the
70s. You were a close personal friend of Bugs Bunny.
What's that? What'd you say? I'm sorry.
I said I thought you were a close personal friend of Bugs Bunny.
Oh, yeah, right, exactly. No, that's, yeah. No, I'm his phantom friend. Yeah. That's who he's always talking to. Who knew? Anyway, so I thought identity was the issue. So, and I've been very involved with what's been called the user-centric identity movement. So, on a podcast called Gilmore Gang in late 2004, I convened a whole bunch of people that were all working on identity, including some really smart, good people at Microsoft that had open source inclinations, and I wanted them to be involved. And so that was Kim Cameron and some of his colleagues, and I just invited them all to take part in this one conversation, and that turned into something called the Identity Gang. And a guy named John Clippinger, who was a fellow at the Berkman Center, intercepted me at a conference saying, "You want a clubhouse for this thing? I think we should volunteer the Berkman Center for that." And that's the Berkman Center at Harvard, to which I'd never been and didn't know anything about. I knew about it. I knew Lawrence Lessig was a fellow there, but I didn't know much else. And I said, sure. And of course, they gave us a clubhouse the easiest possible way. A guy named Paul Trevithick created a wiki. He bought identitygang.org, created a wiki, took a Berkman logo, stuck it on it, and then we had a wiki, and everything began from there. So then we started some workshops, which turned into what are known as the Internet Identity Workshops, or IIW, which have grown to several hundred in attendance every time. They're kind of like a bar camp. People, you know, kind of pay the hat. But OpenID pretty much grew out of that. Brad Fitzpatrick created OpenID for, as a assistant. You all familiar with OpenID? I'm sure you've all at least heard of OpenID. OpenID is, there was Skip, there's OpenID, there's Higgins, there's Microsoft's CardSpace. Higgins is basically the open source version of Microsoft's CardSpace. These things have all grown in a really wonderful way where we have parallel development efforts that all meet and everybody tries to do development that doesn't crash into each other. And it's been wonderful and I felt really good about being part of it, but I realized it was not only not necessarily necessary but insufficient but possibly not even necessary, that the problem was actually somewhat deeper and different than identity alone, that it was really a matter of relationship. There are, you all familiar with customer relationship management, CRM systems? Yeah, so even if you're not familiar with them, you deal with them almost every day if you get junk mail, you deal with them if you get, if you have to make a call to a call center, if you're feeling marketed to at any time by a large company, there's almost always a CRM system involved. CRM is a well-meaning, big company software business that was started by Tom Siebel. Siebel Systems is now owned by Oracle. Oracle CRM used to be Siebel. SAP has it. Salesforce is basically that. There are open source versions of it. Sugar CRM is one. That was the first big one. There are many others now besides. All CRM systems do is try to create relationships with customers inside the silo. That is, they bear the entire burden of the relationship, and therefore it's not a relationship at all. You're not really relating except on their terms. You know, so they know a little bit about you, but really not much. They know enough so they can spam you with more junk mail and other things like that, or maybe they know you when you call them on the phone. And it's very much tied into marketing, and it's tied into advertising, and it's tied into trying to keep you a customer, but it's not about knowing you as a person and not knowing what you really want. The latest and greatest and I think most awful thing that CRM systems have created are the loyalty cards. You know, I see some of us, I'm sure, here old enough to remember green stamps, when green stamps are a big thing, right? Green stamps are actually, you know, green stamps are these stamps that you couldn't go to a store without getting green stamps along with your change. And the whole idea is that you would collect these green stamps, they look like postage stamps, and you pasted them, you licked the back and you pasted them. Oceans of saliva were spread putting green stamps into books. And an interesting thing is the book that has been published that had the largest single sum of, I forget what exactly how to put it, but more green stamp books were published in 1964 than all other books in the world combined. That's how big green stamps were at that time. And it was all bullshit. It was all it started out like, well, we'll have green stamps and they won't, and that will attract people to us, but then everybody had green stamps, and it was this inconvenience for everybody, and it was just and the interesting thing is the majority of green stamps are never cashed in. You know, there's still some in drawers all over the place. The company still exists. It was actually founded in 1882. But, you know, people have been wanting to do this for a long time, to create ways to trap customers and bring them in one or another, or in economic terms, to create switching costs that were too high so people wouldn't go to the other place. Well, the interesting thing with loyalty cards is that they're copied. The brick and mortar world took something that was broken on the net and then brought it to the brick and mortar world. What was broken on the net is that you had to become a member of a store to shop there. You know, you don't have to become a member of Nordstrom. This is another one I got from my wife. She said, I don't have to become a member of Nordstrom in order to buy some shoes there. You know, I don't have to click off accept to a bunch of legalese that I don't read and give all advantages to the seller before I start doing business there. Well, that system was created in the mid-90s when we didn't know any better, and the web was still new, and the lawyers were brought in, and the lawyers created a few terms of service agreements that have been copied and pasted by other lawyers ever since. We haven't really improved that very much. So now they're copying it in the brick and mortar world. And an interesting thing about that is I actually have a friend who has a janitor's ring with these key fobs. I mean, I've got one here. My kid put this on here. Here's one for Borders Books, right there. So he's got a key fob like this that has like 50 of these things, you know, and they, all with a very personal barcode for him, right? You know, it's completely silly. And the thing is, it introduces.
Oh no, we have YubiKey.
You've got any one of us here would start thinking of all kinds of much better ways to do this, right? Because we're the customers, right? But companies are really stupid about this because they're all copying each other. They're all doing the same dumb things. Two interesting things happened recently that sort of illustrate what's wrong with the siloed system for controlling how the customer relates to you. One was with the Harvard MIT coup, okay, where there's one on Harvard Square. I shop there pretty often for books and other things like that. And all of a sudden, a few months back, they decided they would do loyalty cards. And you had to become a member, but not the way co-ops are normally members. It's actually run by Borders or Barnes and Noble, wherever they get their books from. And either you filled out a long form by hand or you went online. And so I went online, and it was a really complicated thing that actually didn't work. It failed when I tried to do it. Well, that's a bunch of friction right there, and I didn't do it. I didn't shop there anymore. They can't measure that. They don't know. They didn't know they lost me. There are other places to buy books. There are other places to get a cup of coffee around Harvard Squares. I don't need to go in there. So how can inside a siloed system like that, they're looking at the hall of mirrors that is their own version of the world and not seeing what they're missing, and that's become pro forma. It's actually a sick thing inside the business system. And the other one was. And this will get us into some of what we're actually doing and some of the problems we're actually solving. There's a Windows moment over there. Uh-oh, didn't boot in the right partition, right? Oh, didn't hit that thing fast enough. How many people have dual boot Windows and Linux here? probably half of us. On Saturday mornings, WMBR, the station here at MIT, has some really cool bluegrass country stuff. I don't even know who does it. It's a great show. A couple of shows on Saturday morning, and I was at a public radio conference. I'm involved in public radio to some degree, and I decided, you know what? I like these guys. I'm going to throw some money at them. So I went to the WMBR site, and it has a place in the front that says fundraising drive. I click on that. It says, our drive is over. Thank you for participating. Okay, and so I went to, after that, so there was another thing that said underwriting. I went to that, and it was like a page of legalese that was about as daunting. It was talking to large companies that want to, give money to the station. And really no place to go with that. It was just like a copy of something. And so I gave up on that. I didn't give them money either. So the interesting thing there is I actually like to support public broadcasting, so I actually give money to about 10 different radio stations, mostly radio stations. I don't watch TV, and I time how long it takes to give the money. It never comes in under 3.5 minutes. And the way they raise money is generally by turning off. They have these fundraising drives. They turn off programming for 2 weeks, plead poverty, and promise you a cup if you send them some money, and then call you a member, and then spam you with direct mail and email and other stuff like that. And membership consists of basically giving the money. It isn't anything more than that in most cases. So I felt that that's an interesting place to work on solving the problem. Yes?
There was one interesting variant of that in which, for a month, a certain non-commercial radio station randomly commuted their entire schedule each week.
Hmm.
And unless you had the program guide for that month, you didn't know where your show was going to be.
Oh really?
Yes.
Yeah, there's so many stories. So
how many listeners did they lose that week?
Yeah. Well, it's the point though is that when you leave it all this stuff up to the sell side, it's really pretty metastasized. It's not working real well. Okay. The economy rolls along, but we've got this notion, in the same way as I remember back in, I love this period of time. I want to find one of these magazines. In the early 80s, there was Data Communications magazine. It was about that thick. And there was a Communications Week magazine. And in it were all of these stories about which is, which is the best network? Is it Ethernet or OmniNet or Corvus or SciTech or you know, do you want a bus or a star or a ring network and token ring versus all these other things? And all of them were these vertical stacks, right? You could not, none of them communicated with each other. You know, IBM would sell you four kinds of cables and four kinds of stacks that ran on top of those cables. You had to rip everything out of your ceilings and everywhere else. They made a huge living making incompatible networks all over the place, right? Probably a bunch of them have been put in and uninstalled in all of these places. Probably still some of them laying in the ceilings, this old cabling in a lot of these places. So, but that changed somewhere in when Ethernet more or less won. There's a whole story behind that that might be worth going into. But we're kind of like that with business right now. We actually think...
No, strictly speaking, that's not really accurate.
Okay.
The TCPIP happened, and the underlying hardware...
Okay, exactly. That's the point. So what happened was the internet a protocol took care of all the business, right? All you needed was a protocol. You could put any data link. You take the bottom layers of the ISO stack and swap anything you wanted in and out below that protocol, and you put any other protocols and applications on top of it. And that was it, right?
Yeah, I remember Ethernet had like seven different layers to it. We're just using the bottom two layers.
Exactly, exactly. And since they were swapped in and out all kinds of stuff around around that. So, but we fixed that. That's my point. We had the internet protocol fixed that. It made it possible to do all kinds of other stuff. And we have a similar, and we look back on that as kind of a ludicrous time that we actually thought a network was something you bought from a company and you were stuck with whatever that was. Well, we have a similar thing with business where we think a free market is your choice of captor. Right? That's the business model that we've had for a long time. And the Wall Street Journal had a piece a few weeks ago where they were knocking net neutrality and the guys that like net neutrality because it was against the market. You know, they wouldn't let the market do its work. Well, what's the market? You know, it's Comcast versus Verizon. That's a market. You know, it's your choice of captor, right? So, and what I wanted to do, and what I wanted to do with the identity work, was not just fight that stuff as a supplicant. You know, this is what we tend to do. Let's go complain to a company, or let's form a union and come in as the poor, humble users or customers and plead for sufferance, you know, and to make things better. I'd rather hack something that unfucks the system. So that's what I wanted to do. I've been covering hackers for a long time. I thought, now it's time for us to write some code that fixes the problem. And so that's why we came up with Project VRM. So, let's see, wake up. Okay, so... So VRM came out of, it stands for Vendor Relationship Management. It's the reciprocal of Customer Relationship Management. And the idea is, let's equip customers with tools that make them both independent from all these silos and better able to engage with them. It's not like we're going to go fight these systems. Let's unscrew these systems. Let's give them, I mean, right now their problem is they're carrying the burden of the whole relationship. Well, what if they have something to actually relate to that could be better? So, for example, we're working with a number of law students and lawyers and other people kicking around, or the Harvard Law School, or just in the general Berkman cloud, to come up with terms of service that we assert. Right? You know, as a customer walking into a store, you generally have goodwill. You know, you don't need to be dressed down by a lawyer when you walk into a store saying, "Can we really trust you? Sign this to make sure we trust you." Right? That kind of distrust that you encounter every time you want to do business on the web is not part of the brick and mortar life. It's not part of what we've done. So is it possible to come up with terms of service that we assert that where we can put this in or pull that out? Can we do this? And conceptually, we think we can. So that's one thing that we're working on. And there are some others, and I'm gonna run them down. What's happened over the last couple years that we've been working on this is that, and this is a wiki, as you see, and it's not a landing web page. We don't have any much publicity about this. I actually tried publicizing it a bit about a year and a half ago, and I ended up spending the next 3 months debugging a bunch of assumptions made about it, and I realized in the absence of code, we're not going to be able to demonstrate what we want to do. So I enjoy talking to, you know, people like you guys because, you know, you understand what the code matters and that we have to hack something together here. So it's still in early stages, so I'll tell you a little bit of some of the different projects that we're working on. The first, and not the first. There are a lot that are happening in parallel. I'll tell you one that I can't show, but it's very easy to conceive. There's a guy named Ian Henderson working in the UK. And by the way, the hotbed of activity is actually in the UK. It's not here. There's some in Boston, some in California, and a bunch, big bunch of people in the UK that are really hot to go.
Why is it hot in the UK?
I don't know. It just happened that way, you know. There's some in Germany. What's that?
Infringement upon their rights.
Huh?
They probably have a lot of infringements upon their rights, things that we don't have here.
Well, I think in the case of...
All those spy cameras, basically everywhere in public.
Track your car.
You know, it's sort of like, you know, the free software movement started here because Stallman was here. Well, there are a few people that are there and are working on some stuff, and that's all there is to it. I think it helps to be in a smaller country in a way where you have a sense that if you start something, it'll reach the perimeters faster. I sense that when I talk to people over there, that there's a sense that, not that it's absent here, having worked in Silicon Valley, everybody imagines the world's going to use my shit in about 45 minutes, right? So it usually takes a little longer, but Ian has been a veteran in customer relationship management for a long time, and he noticed, for example, that in a business-to-business relationship between companies, say Boeing wants to buy tires, right? So for a 747, and they'll send out an RFP to Firestone and Bridgestone and, you know, a few other companies that make tires. And in that kind of a relationship, there are actually over 3,500 variables that come into play. And I don't know what they all are, but Ian does. He's actually tracked all these down. In what they call a business-to-consumer relationship, there are about two. I mean, it's just like, this is address, maybe credit history, maybe transaction history, but there's not much. You know, their companies know remarkably little about us. And in fact, their silos in their CRM systems are mostly exercises in minimizing what they know about customers, because they're looking for populations, not for individuals. Their relationships are more with your demographic group than with other aspects about you, because they want to lump you into groups. This is why the surveys they send out are always silly. You know, there was a survey that I filled out for, in order to get free Wi-Fi at the Omni Hotel in Austin, Texas these last few days. I had to fill out a survey to become a member of their loyalty program, right? And the questions were, none of them asked the questions that I actually cared about, like, do I care about the internet? This is the only thing I care about. I want a place to sleep, and I want the damned internet, right? I want it fast and not failing. And it didn't work there. You know, that was my main complaint. You know, I went down, you know, it's, and they usually I bring along a little hotspot, but they didn't have Ethernet in the room. They only had Wi-Fi. It was probably down the hall or something, but it came and it went. And we've escalated it to the manager. Can I talk to the manager? He's not here. It didn't work the whole time. But that was not in the survey. One thing that wasn't in the survey was, what kind of newspaper would you like outside your door in the morning? And they listed four. And check all that apply. I checked all four. There still was no newspaper outside the door in the morning. So, you know, that's how stupid this crap is, right? So, I wrote a piece on one of the blogs about how all surveys are wrong. We all know all surveys are wrong because they're not talking to us as individuals. We know what we want. In fact, there's a lot of demand that's laying around in the world that we call MBLOT, money left on the table. The companies don't even know we're there. Like the Coop doesn't know that I'm now buying books somewhere else because I didn't want to go through the trouble of signing up to their program. So how do we fix that? So what Ian's doing is he wants to get those 4,000 some odd variables working on the customer side, but not in a way that's burdensome. So he's creating a data store, and open sourcing it. The format for that, and working on one particular use case, which is change of address. So when you change your address here, you know, generally you're changing addresses with lots and lots of different entities, right? And it would be nice to do it just once for everybody, but in a way that selectively discloses only what you want them to know. That would be a handy thing to do. So he's working on that. And I've been over there visiting him a couple times. He's plugged into Parliament. He's got friends in other places there. It's cool stuff. They're doing cool things there. And by the way, there's a I invite you to look into this. This is a thing called mysociety.com, I think, or .org, mysociety.org. It's a all open source and Linux hack. It's a website where dug by some guys, and actually I hung out with them at a pub in the wee hours of the morning when Obama won the last election. I happened to be in the UK at that time, and so I got to see that there. But they have a web page called fixmystreet.org or .com, and that's all it is. People just go in there and put their complaints down, and it's become actually part of the way the UK government works. The UK government is responding to My Society because My Society has made it possible for individuals to interact with the government at very little cost using a Linux hack, right? So, and I haven't written about them in Linux Journal yet, but I wanted to. In any case, so there are a bunch of people around that community that are working on things. There's a project that we haven't really started yet, but conceptually I really like it, which is the personal RFP. The personal RFP is, I need a stroller for twins in Cambridge in the next 5 hours. Who's got one? My money's good. You know, I'm willing to pay for a stroller for twins. Right now, you can go to Craigslist, you can maybe go to Amazon, you can go to some other place, but wouldn't it be nice if we could advertise our demand as well as people, as companies advertise their demand at us, and do it in a selectively disclosed way that's secure, and then invites what we call fourth-party services. These are ones that are answerable to customers, or user-driven services. So the whole concept of user-driven services rather than seller-driven services, customer-driven services, is a big one. We actually expect, if we start equipping customers with tools that can express their demand much better than they can right now, can do, for example, a global preference. And a global preference might be, if we're doing business, I don't want to get any promotional literature. That's prima facie. We're not going to do business unless we have that. Or another one might be, this is just business logic. If I'm calling for tech support, then I want to reach a human being in under a minute, and I'm willing to pay a buck for that. I have demand for that. I have a demand for talking to a human being and not being lost in a call center maze. And I really, I'm willing to pay for that. I can put money out there. How can we do that? And so that's part of the system we're putting together. So now the project that's front and center for me right now, which is going on right here in Cambridge, let's see if I can show something with this on. Let's say look at recent changes and see what somebody's done there. Go here. Let's see, pay choice. Okay, here we go. So I want to go back to the public radio model, the public radio problem. Okay. I could ask you, how many people here listen to public radio? So how many people pay for it? How many people send money to WBUR or one station? A couple, three of you. How many of you do it if it was real easy? Yeah. There's always more. Okay. So the point is, and it's the exercise is a little more fun when you have a lot of people in a room, because you get kind of group effects out of it, and you get that sense of rebellion against the awful systems they use to suck money out of you now. So, and that's money left on the table, right? You know, the difficulty they put you through in order to raise money is a rather inefficient thing, but they've perfected it. It's actually a huge part of the way they work. I couldn't begin to tell you the level of expertise that they have in doing these fundraising things. So what we're trying to do is come up with a method for making it easy for any one of us to give any amount we want, whenever we want, to whoever we want, with almost no friction. In other words, I just heard that, I want to send some money to them. Ding, I can do it, or at least record the need for, yeah.
Now you're doing that, you have the choice whether you do that with some name or anonymously, because one of the things I like to do is go to the post office, get a postal money order blank, and mail
that's out. Great. Yeah, that's exactly it. And what you want to do And is one of the reasons for that because you don't want to be in anybody's database?
I don't want nothing.
That's
exactly,
right.
Exactly. See, that's the kind of thing that their systems will never allow, right? They can't even imagine that. You have to be a member. We love you because you give us money, right? Screw that. You know, I mean, Dave Weiner, who's the father of RSS and outlining and many other things, blogging and podcasting among them, he's one of the many fathers, but he's a primary one. He tells a story of, like, he likes On the Media, which is produced by WNYC in New York. And so he sent $100 to WNYC because it always says, and he only listens to podcasts, right? And so he sends $100 to WNYC and he's getting emails, he's on their lists, there's all kinds of stuff comes in the mail, and he doesn't want that. He doesn't care about WNYC. He only cares about On the Media. He wants to just pay them. Yes?
Well, the flip side of that is that in some sense, my name, address, and email has value to me.
Yes.
Maybe not strictly monetary.
Right.
And I'm perfectly willing to give them, you know, whatever considered money, you know, dollars and cents and whatnot. But I'm much more reluctant to give them any contact information.
Right. And what you need is some set of multiple valves that allows you to selectively disclose to them and create the terms of service by which it can be used. And so what PayChoice does, it says, is it's going to be a system whereby we can either commit to money, to any sum of money, or but at least keep track of what we're doing and what we like and what we're willing to pay for and how much on our terms and not their terms. And if they don't like our terms, our money could just sit there and they at least know that there's some money waiting for them and the demand is out there. But they have to get their systems in alignment with ours. And that's part of what we want to do. We want to hack their system by showing them, hey, look, there's actually forms of demand out here that you haven't even thought about. And you can accept it or not. And there may be forms of membership as well. I mean, it could be you want some involvement with WBUR other than just sending the money, right? Maybe you want your tweets to be heard or some other thing like that. There are lots of possibilities there. The opportunities for symbiosis between radio stations and populations are highly interesting and exposed, especially during crises. KPBS in San Diego became the center for dealing with the San Diego fires a couple of years ago, all because they were driven by one guy named Nate Ritter, who had a Twitter stream, and the Twitter stream was called just San Diego Fire. He created a hashtag that was San Diego Fire. Anybody that wrote anything about it, and more news came through that than through any other source. And they dropped their Windows only, IIS served content management system at the station and just started a blogger blog to do nothing but write constantly about it and integrated that with what went on the air. That's an example of what can happen if they actually get involved with listeners who are not just an audience, right? So one reason we like trying this out with public radio is because there's nobody there with a pricing gun. There's no, you know, you don't have to, you know, the stuff is available for free. You know, but it's worth more than nothing. It's available for free, but it's worth more than nothing. So we're not dealing with anybody's inventory management system. We're not dealing with anybody's technical bureaucracy. So there's two sides to that, and let's see if I can find, put it down here, page down, micro accounting projects, public radio tuner, listen log. Okay, so, yeah, so here's the public radio tuner. Public radio tuner is a CPB funded, they know public radio is going to go out. This is a radio now, and it's not just, it's any smartphone. It happens to work best and first on the iPhone. So the public radio tuner is this thing on the iPhone, and over 1,300,000 of these things, or about 250,000, have been downloaded so far. You don't know how many are actually being used, but apparently it's quite a few of them. Here's KQED in San Francisco. There we go. That's KQED in San Francisco. When I'm in California, I listen to WBUR in Boston. I plug this, there's a plug on here, plug it into the car radio. It is a radio. It's running off the cell system. Here's my kid. Hold on a second. Hey, dude. Listen, I'm addressing a whole bunch of people here. I'll be home after I'm done, okay? I'm giving a talk. I'm standing in front of a bunch of people who are staring at me right now, and I'm answering the phone. Okay? That's no problem. I'll talk to you later. I'll call you on my way home, okay? Okay, see you later. 12-year-old kid. So the interesting thing about that is that, and this is the deal. I mean, as evil in many ways, we're back on KQED. As evil and controlling as Steve Jobs is in some ways, he and his people drove a deal with AT&T that broke something that needed to be broken, and that was an unlimited data plan. For $30 a month, I've got an unlimited data plan. I don't care how many bits I suck down, and apparently they don't either. So I listen to all the radio I want. It might be over Wi-Fi. Usually it's over the net. So what do you need transmitters for anymore, right? There's, in the long run, that's going to happen. What you call radio today is going to be happening more and more over the cell system, inevitably. And the nice thing about that is that you can have metadata running alongside it. In fact, there is data running alongside it. So the first thing we're doing is with the public radio tuner, that we're adding to the public radio tuner, is what we call a listen log. And the listen log is going to do nothing but note what you've been listening to, but not for anybody else's marketing purposes, just for you. This is your data. This is a new thing. Hey, data just for you. You know, that answers the question, oh, who was it that Tom Ashbrook was talking to last week that was some professor from MIT? And I need to figure that out. So that data will be there. Okay. In some cases, we'll figure that data out and put it in a place where it can be found and all that. But that's the first thing we're working on, is what we call the listen log. And that we're sort of hot in the middle of that right now. And the listen log system, whatever it's going to be, and it's just in the works right now, and by the way, we're going to have anybody help us out with this, is going to be independent of the iPhone. It's not going to be an iPhone thing. It's going to be on Android. It can be on anything. The whole idea is that there needs to be a system by which you can sort of scrape your own history and add value to it, figure out what that was, answer the question, what was that, mash it up any way you want, share it with whoever you want, but always under your control, always under working for you. And so what, economically speaking, what we want to do is bring buy-side intelligence into the marketplace. So in other words, here's stuff that has value, and I want to find a way to help me figure out what that value is. So the killer thing here isn't just money coming in over the transom to public radio stations that aren't expecting it yet, which is stage one. The holy grail here is fixing the music business. And this is the fun one that I'm looking at probably about 2 years out. And in order to look at that one, and I'll stop after this, we go into more of a Q&A, but you all are familiar with the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, right? Horrible thing that was passed by Congress in October of 1998. In it, among the things that were left unfinished was what to do with live streaming. They didn't know. They didn't have an answer for this. It's too new. The whole thing never should have passed anyway because the net was too new, but the copyright mongers wanted to make sure that the net was as locked down as they could possibly make it. But they left this unsolved. They said, okay, streamers, people who do web streaming, you guys, the web radio stations, get together with the record business and you guys work it out. And they created something called the Copyright Arbitration Royalty Panel to help mediate this and come up with what they called a schedule of rates that would be paid for streaming, right? And in the original language in the DMCA actually had this in it: in the absence of a willing buyer and a willing seller, comma, fill in the blank. And that has persisted until the present. There, since the Copyright Arbitration Royalty Panel came to their conclusions, which just made pretty much all but strangled the internet radio business in the cradle in 2001, that bacon was saved at the last minute with a small webcaster act that was written by Jesse Helms on his way out of office on behalf of the Christian broadcasters, who were his buddies. But they were the babies in his bathwater that were getting killed, right? And and the Christian broadcasters came to him and saved other non-religious, non-commercial broadcasters along with him. But not all of them. A lot of stations went off the air. So after that, everybody agreed this was awful. And then the carve-out that the CPB-funded stations had, they had a private deal that only they had with the RIAA and its collection agency, which is called Sound Exchange. And that ran out. And it ran out because basically it aged out. But nobody on the record company side wanted it because when they made the deal, they thought nobody listened to public radio, and they found out that that's most of where the listening was, and they wanted some money out of that. So a second thing was formed called the Copyright Royalty Board. And the Copyright Royalty Board ended up saying, it was a three-judge panel, ended up saying, okay, there's still no willing buyer and willing seller here, but there is something of value over here, and we're going to give the pricing gun to the sellers, but we're going to set the price. And we're going to set the price at a hundredth of a cent per song per listener. And this, by the way, was higher than any of the stations ever contemplated, and they all threw up all over it, and much wringing of hands and gnashing of teeth has been going on since then. And probably it's still going to get worked out because Pandora has become huge, and Tim Westergren, who started Pandora, is driving a deal directly with some of the record companies, bypassing this whole process. But in the meantime, there's still this thing about willing buyers and willing sellers. And when I heard that, even though I sympathized with all the stations, I thought, on the buy side, what if I am a willing buyer? What if I actually do value the music, and I actually, right now, I mean, it's not like old radio is still here. I'm very deliberate about what music I'm listening to on the radio. I don't have to put up with what one station in town tells me to listen to. I can listen to whatever I want. Or I can hear Serendipity on WMBR or WUMB or Pandora or one of those. I like to give them 100 times that. I like to give them a penny a song. But I'd like to, why not? So what we're going to do with PayChoice downstream after we get the thing worked out with public radio is, and there's a little side of it, that we may work some of this out with Apple because it isn't even that hard to do. We don't even need Apple to do it, but they're actually quite friendly on this issue because they like the stations they get paid. Is to make it easy for us to keep track of what music we're listening to, and then to escrow the intention to pay, say, a penny a song or whatever value we want. And there can be all kinds of fourth party services that exist to do nothing but hold our deposits. I've talked to some people at Wells Fargo Bank about this already. They'd be glad to pay this to do this service where, if I listen to one Neil Young song and I hear that, but it gets played 100 times across the country and that comes up to a buck, or maybe it pays, as soon as it crosses over to a sum large enough that it's economically rational to pay it, all of a sudden these artists get paid the pennies that are being scraped off lots of people. But it's not micropayments, which is a red herring and generally doesn't work, but it's microaccounting. And what we want to do is microaccounting of what we're doing, which is basically just accounting. But we call it microaccounting because micropayments is kind of a hot topic. Walter Isaacson of Time Magazine had a cover story about how to save newspapers. Here's how you do it. You do it with micropayments. Well, a lot of people in tech know that micropayments has never quite worked, but microaccounting might. So that's in the works, and that's also going to be all open source and as much as we can. So that's there's more going on than those things, but that's probably enough for now. So, questions? Ideas? Yes?
This is going to sound a bit odd, but I recently used the Creative Commons site called freesound.org.
Freesound?
Freesound. It's a collection of various sound effects.
Uh-huh.
And it was very much like what you just said. I actually did want to donate them some money.
Yeah.
And their whole thing is broken.
Yeah. So you run across this all the time. The artists like Brad Sucks, Nine Inch Nails, Radiohead, they all have giving away some music. Prince did it for a while, right? But you have to do it their way on their sites, and those always take a bunch of time. And I think it'll stay broken until we fix it. It's sort of like, networking was broken until the geeks came up with TCP/IP. It doesn't matter who came up with it or how or why, it's just that here is something in the world that solve that problem and to solve it in a straightforward way. That it has, this is a, something that I observed, and to some degree some people have used the term as well, that all free software and open source has characteristics we call NEA, we being Linux Journal, which stands for nobody owns it, everybody can use it, and anybody can improve it. And while that's not exactly true, because everything's owned to some degree, it is true that everybody can use it, and it is true that anybody can improve it if you have the goods, if you have the chops, you can come in and contribute the code. And that's how the world is filled. I think there, 2 years ago, Steve Larson, who runs a company called Krugle, K-R-U-G-L-E, which does code search, kind of like Google code search. They're more corporate now, but Coders was another one that did that. He said there were, at that point, they knew there were at least 500,000 open source code bases in the world. And that was several years ago. It's not possible to count how many there are. This is all free building material. And it's kind of like the physical world, we're dealing with the periodic table. That's what we build the physical world with. But in the virtual world, we're creating all these other elements that are boundless in sum, and we can improve them all over the place. And anyway, that's, I just wanted to share that, because that's part of my optimism comes out of that. I know that, I mean, and it's been very easy for us. I mean, we're in working on ListenLog and on PayChoice, the question isn't what code we have to write, but what code we put together. You know, it's like, you know, the open source code are like these Lego blocks that are laying around in the world. They all come from different, you know, here's one from Star Wars system, and here's one from Barbie's car and some other things, but you can still put these together in ways that work. So, and that's, you know, that's part of what gives me a lot of optimism about being able to solve the problem. I also think it's inevitable. I think the market needs customers, it needs individuals to have more power, more practical power. It's not like, let's rise up and screw people power, but it's rather, I just have a tool here. And as you pointed out before, I mean, why should we have a loyalty card? You know, we can have a, you know, I mean, you know, this should have, maybe there's even a barcode on here, you know, which is just, you know, this is my barcode that I came up with, and I can share it with you, and I walk into Starbucks, and I swipe it on something, and it knows that I want a decaf cappuccino.
Yeah, this is actually the opposite of those loyalty cards.
Yeah.
There's a one-time password device to, I believe it, where it interoperates with OpenID.
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so
it's kind of like an RSA token that doesn't need a server backend.
Exactly. Yes?
The idea that I have for this is sort of the reverse of RSS. Where, like, you know, in my RSS reader, I subscribe to a bunch of feeds, be that podcast or text or whatever. And if I know I want to contribute to one of these projects, right? I should just be able to select those and say, you know, I want to give $10 to this guy and give $50 to him.
Right.
So, I mean, it seems like all that needs is some kind of central registry for all these different entities to come and say, you know, I'm willing to accept funds, and here's, you know, my whatever information.
Right.
I'm not sure I like the word central in that.
Well, yeah, well, the centralization that we want to make happen is centralization around you. It's your central. You're the silo.
Yeah.
Right.
It can be distributed. It doesn't have to be, you know, some corporate entity owning the server or whatever, right?
RSS is definitely part of the way we can see this, that you know, I would like, I mean, for example, let's say I have relationships with, just to get away from public radio for a while, let's say you're into fly fishing, you know, and I have relationships with 10 different organizations that have something to do with fly fishing. I wouldn't mind syndicating my interest in fly fishing in some way that informs them of what I might want. Or when it comes time to order something, or just to inform them, hey, I'm going up to Lake Manicouagan, what do I need for trout there? You know, that's real relationship. But relationship is actually two-way, you know, so we need something at our side that can bear some of that weight. So there will be third-party services, though. I mean, so for example, I mean, banks are a really good example because they're working for us, essentially. You know, it's a place, we don't have to carry all our money around with us. We don't want to carry all our money around with us. We want to put it someplace where it can be used. And the relationships they have that we put to use are really very simple. right? Or transfer this to there, end of story, not too complicated. But as it comes time to pile up all our preferences and, you know, all of our, keep track of all these different relationships, there will be third-party services that will come along, but they'll be working for us. And one of the things we talk about is there's a movement called data portability. So, and we know a number of the people, and there are actually some very active here. Trent Adams, Trent's his first name, is one of the guys there working on that. And the whole idea there is that, you know, I can move my data from Amazon to, like, let's say, I want to be able to move my movie reviews from, you know, my movie reviews with Amazon will also be in Yahoo and also be with Rotten Tomatoes, right? Why should I have to do them separately in all those different silos? Right, that's data portability. But there's also service portability. You don't want to get locked into somebody's service if you want to be able to say, okay, you know, you're not working out. Banks have service portability. You can pull your money out of here and put it over there. It's actually substitutability in economic terms. You need to be able to have those. Even if you're the central point of, as Joe Andrew, who's one of probably the most active developer on in our little crew, talks about the user, the individual being the point of integration for their own data and the point of origination about what's done with it. And but there will be user-driven services that are coming out of that. So, and we spent much of the last week in Austin talking about creating basically the format for grassroots organizing around individual rights and individual assertion of rights that for user-driven services. You know, so if you're an insurance company, insurance companies are another example of something that works for you. So if we come up with new standards for the way that works, how do we promulgate that? How do we make it work? So that's part of the tip.
So, to me, that means that you have to have a way of disseminating your personal wants to the vendors that is in a format that they can receive.
Right.
Interpret. So at this point, it seems. Like
so we yeah, and the question is, so there are several different ways of looking at that. One is, what standards for selective disclosure do we want to use? Where does crypto come in? How do we do crypto without making it too complicated, which is a really old problem, you know, talking even to techies about public key cryptography is pretty complicated, but there will be ways of doing it, but those are all open questions. We're facing that right now, and the biggest problems are actually not so much around how we do it technically, but how we explain it to people and how we make it easy. You know, so, and that's another area where the folks in the UK are working on it. They have something that called individually asserted something or other. It used to be called volunteered personal information. We didn't like that name, but so some other name is. But and they're working with some of the standards bodies on how to describe how this is done. You know, how do we selectively disclose on an as needed basis with people that we trust? How do we revoke the trust? One of the things we want to be able to do is blow up a relationship and we're done with it. Or even have a passing relationship that has, not, as you say, with the anonymous stuff, right? You know, if all I want is a cup of coffee and all you need to know is that I want a short cappuccino, you know, I may give you a name that you can call out when you give me the coffee. It doesn't even need to be my name. It just needs to be one that I know, right? So, and in fact, this kind of anonymity is what allows the world to work. You know, it's important for retailers to not know the identity of everybody who comes to the door. It's too much trouble, honestly. All you care about is that they're going to buy some stuff and they have some cash and that they're not going to ruin your reputation or something else like that. So, as my wife puts it, you know, the part of the challenge is to take the ease that we have operating in the retail environment in the brick and mortar world and bring it online. It's not there yet. It's still too complicated in some ways. Yes?
Are the screensavers key to your talk?
No, no. This isn't my machine. It's I guess it's his machine. That's interesting, though, isn't it?
Looks like it's playing.
It's funny being upstaged by a screensaver, isn't it? It's yeah. I go back and Oh, that's not the one. Oh, the public radio tuner. Go back here and go back one. Yeah, so there's the wiki's got lots of stuff going on in it, too much stuff going on in it. Like all wikis have one problem or the other. One is that nobody does anything with it. The other is that too much gets done with it and it's a mess. So we have the latter. It kind of goes in a bursty way. So there's micro accounting there, but there's a list of principles somewhere in here. Yes, we have some.
Or at least they used
to
be a list of
principles. Well, oh, that's pay choice. Okay, go back one more. Two more. Yeah, about VRM here. Page down. Oops, over here. Yeah, so, and these keep changing a bit, you know, you know, what is it about relationships? You know, they're voluntary. Customers are born free and independent of vendors. Customers control their own data. They share it selectively. Their points of integration and origination. We can assert our own terms of engagement and service. And we're free to express our demands and intentions outside any company's control. That kind of stuff. So my models here are the free software definition and the open source definition. You know, the GNU manifesto and those founding documents that get updated gradually over the years. I don't think we quite have it yet, actually. I think we actually, I mean, the advantage that Richard had with, who really started this stuff, was with the GNU manifesto was, you know, Unix had been around for a while. He had a problem with the way that was done, and he wanted to create substitute tools for what were already there. We're in virgin territory with a lot of this stuff. We've never had a lot of what we're trying to talk about. And there are unproven theses here. We don't know if some of this stuff is going to work. The fortunate thing is I'm not wasting any VC's money right now. You know,
I think the reason is that no company is interested in solving this problem.
They can't even. It's interesting that there are people inside companies that can imagine it. And we're being in a bad economy right now is a big advantage because a lot of companies don't have that overwhelming confidence they used to have that their poop doesn't stink, right? So then they have the answer to everything is they're busy suffering. So they're willing to listen to some things they weren't willing to listen to before. The thing that always surprises them the most is how much stuff customers know that they don't, right? So and if we talk to the economically minded ones and say, look, there's a shortage of intelligence in the marketplace. There's a shortage of intelligence in your own systems. You don't have a lot of intelligence that the customers can bring to you. And they know what's out there now because, you know, like Dell, with Dell realized after Jeff Jarvis put them through Dell hell by publishing it all over the place, and they started Dell Idea Storm. And what had happened then? You know, what do we want? It was all Linux. Everything was like, you know, we want Ubuntu. We don't want the Microsoft logo on. We don't want this and that and the other thing. And they heard it. They had to deal with it, right? That's not really efficient. When you have to put up a site and have people stone you with complaints, something's still not quite right. It'd be a lot better if you just, I mean, they make custom stuff, you know. Here, I want a trackpad and I want the little nipple thing and I want this and that, and or I want a Dvorak keyboard or I want, you know, or we could do, one thing we've talked about a lot is doing like you do in Wall Street, you know, I want to put a put on the market, you know. I'm gonna buy a Lenovo that weighs under 5 pounds and has a 500 gigabyte drive in it, and is you know has a dual core Intel whatever. Just name a bunch of stuff that's not there yet, but I have demand for that. I got a couple grand waiting for that when it comes along. I'm letting you know, guys, you know that's the kind of thing you need to be able to do, or to even say. And even if it doesn't come along, you know, if it doesn't meet your requirements, to be able to have a way of saying these things that can be heard. Right, I don't know how many times I've gone through this, probably all of us have, where we're talking to a call center and we have a form of demand that they're just not willing to hear. They can't do it. I had that I get Verizon Fios at our house in Arlington, right? That's one reason we're there. We have a fairly crummy apartment, but that has fiber to the home, right? So I'm getting 20 megabits symmetrical internet. And I had their triple play thing, right? They had the POTS phone upstairs and I had the TV. We realized we never watch television. On top of that, I once sat in a plane next to a guy from Verizon who explained to me that their set-top box, which is a Motorola box, comes with Linux on it, and they scrape it off and put their own proprietary crap on there, and it doesn't work very well, right? And he said, because we shouldn't do that. The guy was a Linux hacker. He said, well, why are we doing that? For that matter, why do we even have a set-top box? Why don't we just put a pipe into your house and there's a you know, there's a source that's called television, and it's got some restrictions to it, but you can do Myth TV directly on it because you've got a box that does that, and people can compete in the box business, right? No. They want to control the whole darn thing. They want to verticalize the whole damn thing. So is that
Verizon's problem, or is it?
It is for them. For me, it is. I cut off the television. And so
no, but
that's actually a general problem.
It's a general problem. They all copy each other, you know. So for Verizon's new to the cable TV business, so they're copying Comcast and they're copying.
But what I've heard is that the content companies are the ones forcing them to do this. They say ESPN comes and says, unless you do this, we're not.
They all say that. It's all crap. I mean, they're all smoking their own exhaust, and they, you know, that's really what's going on. Just a second on this. But this is an interesting exercise, right? Just try this with your, if you have cable, just try this. Just threaten to get rid of it. Just call them up and take them right to the end of it, and you'll be amazed at how much they'll knock off the price.
Oh, yeah.
So I was paying get this, on Verizon Fios, here's what they came down to. All of HBO, all of Showtime, Stars, all the premium networks, plus the set-top box, plus a bigger hard drive in the set-top box, plus, you know, free everything, and 100 HD channels for $47.99. That's what they came down to. That's a hell of a deal if you like television. It's really a great deal. But I said, you know what? What I want is a la carte, and I want to be. I told him, here's what I want, and she said, we really can't give that to you. I said, well, let's cut it off. Bye, you know, and gave me a place to, you know, haul the box down to Newton and turn it in, you know. But I kept the internet, right? I can do that. So
I asked the same thing.
When
I said I want a la carte, then they said we can't do it without a set-top box.
Exactly. Well, they tried to do, you know. We had that with computing, and it didn't work, right? So, and we discovered that 30 years ago. And we discovered it with the internet, with email. You know, we had CompuServe and AOL and those other ones, and that all blew up. Yes?
When I first started off this talk, I had something somewhat different in mind from what you actually presented. And I'll actually give an example that has appeared on the internet as to what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain authors who essentially have... said that they'll distribute and print their book once they get a certain amount of money from
mm-hmm.
various people. And they keep track of, you know, who gave them money and signed copies or something like that. And I was wondering, is there anything comparable that envisioned in your scheme? In other words, if there's a demand for some product that isn't out there right now, there are a number of people who do not want it and can somehow, you know, put some money into escrow.
That's part of what PayChoice can do. The whole idea is that, you know, let's create ways for demand to express itself that are standard. And that's the key thing. We want to be able to standardize this in a way. So the problem we have now is that that author can put out a tip jar saying, you know, when this gets to $5,000, I'm gonna publish this book. Right. Well, you have to go to his site and go through a bunch of shit with that, you know. Instead, wouldn't it be better if we just said, you know, any number of people could get together and say, yeah, I've already got $5 committed, you'll find it over here. Whatever that system is, we have to imagine that out. What's clear is that it's conceivable, and if it's conceivable, we can code it, you know. And then we have to create the UI and the ease of connecting at the back end required for this, you know. And then hope we don't step on some idiot's patents that they want to blow it up with or something, but even Microsoft being very friendly about all this, so I don't.
I'm curious if
that.
You're patenting anything that you're
no.
talked about. So is there a risk somebody might steal your ideas?
He's copywriting.
I'm stealing ideas.
No, you copy. Just put it on the wiki, and then if anybody patents it, you claim prior art.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot here that's and there's some stuff that's similar to some other things. I'm not worried about that. I it's not my nature basically. There are reasons to worry about everything. There are all worst possible scenarios for all kinds of stuff, but I'm not worried about it. There is a need, there's definitely a need by some of the people that are contributing to this project that have code already written that's in a proprietary format, and they're looking for ways to release it, and they're looking for some guidance with that. We're looking to, you know, what kind of organization do we create? The Berkman Center isn't built for that. The Berkman Center holds one standard, and it's RSS 2.0, and that was given by Dave Weiner to the Berkman Center just to depoliticize it. And it had a terrific effect, because all of that was the one that had the include element that allowed podcasting to happen. But
does Berkman make money off of that?
Oh no, God no. Oh no, it's just it's a web page. There's nothing more to it than that.
Yeah.
So, you know, this we're in the area where something is what you say it is. You know, it's that that's all. You know, we have an agreement. It's over here. It's on a website. Yeah. You know, I mean, ideally, I really like the IETF model, which is loose consensus and running code. I want that. You know, I like loose consensus and running code, or rough consensus rather than running code is what the statement is. And you get that going, and then after a while, people don't screw with it. Right. This is too interesting. Anything else? You want to go get some beer?
Why don't we raffle?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody.
How many hands do we have?